If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right, all right. It is Monday. It's 12 o'clock on the dot, kids. And it's time for What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with your best friend, Katie Kiefer. Just call me Auntie Katie. And I am here to bring you another great show. I am delighted, as part of my Joys and Sorrows segment, I'll just start by saying I am filled with joy at the prospect of my guest today. Her name is Anna LaPay. I will give you a more formal introduction in a few moments, but I think pretty much everybody out there who listens to the show regularly knows who Anna LaPay is. So I am delighted to bring her onto the show. But onward to the various joys and sorrows of my life and yours, by the way. The Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, this is at the very end of his term, right? He tried, he failed, he shelved for about 7 years, something called GPSA, the GPSA rule, otherwise known as trust busting in the agricultural sector. Anyway, he is back at it again, and especially against big meat companies. You will actually be hearing a lot more about that on December 5th when I have booked the fantastic Christopher Leonard, the author of The Meat Racket, one of my favorite books about the meat industry and something that I found absolutely galvanizing, certainly when I turned to writing my own book. But Chris Leonard is about to publish a major article on the subject of antitrust litigation within the meat industry, or rather consolidation and concentration within the meat industry and what that means. As you probably know, it is one of the most egregiously consolidated industries in the world. And as you will learn upon reading my book, What's the Matter with Meat, which will come out next March, that concentration has had enormous and negative consequences for rural communities, for workers, for the environment, and much, much more. We simply cannot raise meat the way we do now. It has to be changed. So we will look forward to hearing what Chris has to say about that. But in the meantime, it's great news that Vilsack and the USDA are finally trying to start busting up some of these giant conglomerates and multinational companies that are basically price fixing, you know, and running the tournaments that Chris Leonard described so aptly in his book, The Meat Racket. That's one of the facets of the litigation that Vilsack is beginning to push towards unraveling the meat industry lock. So next up on the Joys and Sorrows score, did you all see the big piece in the Times yesterday that revealed what most of us already know, but somehow it's news again, which is that genetically modified organisms or crops do not increase the yield of their plants, but they do increase the use of herbicides. That's been pretty well documented over the last 10 years. They came into being, I think, somewhere around 1997 was the release of the first GMO, or maybe it was 94 with the Flavor Saver tomato. That went the way of the dodo, but the other crops like corn, soy, rice, cotton, etc. I think what else is papayas in Hawaii are genetically modified. I think that's about it. I think they're working on a potato that doesn't turn brown. I know there's an apple that doesn't turn brown. But most crops, in case you didn't know this, are not genetically modified or genetically, they are hybridized, but they are not engineered by putting genes from other species into their DNA, which is what genetic modification actually means. No one seems ready to throw out the idea of genetically modified crops, though, and the industry, which is consolidating as fast as it possibly can, will soon make it even harder for farmers to buy any commercial seed in the commodity category that is not genetically modified. And can I just take a moment now to remark on the success of how on how fast companies have adopted the label of no GMO, no matter what the product is, in the interests of marketing to GMO-phobic people. Yesterday, for example, a friend of mine was telling me that her jar of curry powder was labeled no GMO. Well, there is no genetically modified spice. What might be genetically modified is the cornstarch that they might introduce into that product to keep it from caking up or getting too wet. But certainly the spices themselves are not genetically modified. So, you know, if you look at all these labels that say no GMO, it's just a marketing ploy 99 times out of 100. And so I think that, you know, it's important to think about this as a greenwashing tool that plays on your fears, on people's fears of the safety of genetically modified organisms, when the reality is, you know, study after study has shown that there seems to be no consequence to consuming them. And indeed, we have been consuming huge quantities of them in the form of high fructose corn syrup for, well, over a decade. We do have obesity as a result of eating sugary drinks and bad food, but I'm not sure that that can be laid directly at the door of genetically modified organisms. I'd be surprised. The real problem with GMOs, in my opinion, is that they represent a monopoly over seeds. And when only three or four companies in the world are controlling most of the seed stock, then you have a problem. And that's why we need to be fighting against genetically modified organisms. In other good news, and this really is amazing, and I hope that that this company gets the credit that is due. The Purdue Meat Company, Purdue Chicken, has committed to no antibiotics ever in their flocks. It's a very, very impressive step forward. They are the only ones who have done this, and they should be recognized for their efforts. In addition, they have made a public commitment to the Five Freedoms, which is a global standard of animal welfare, which includes, you know, like the freedom to, you know, exhibit natural behaviors like roosting or rolling in mud or, you know, whatever that is. There's a whole bunch of them. Freedom from fear and distress, freedom from hunger, freedom from cold, freedom from pain, freedom from being not allowed to exhibit your natural behavior. So those are the five freedoms. And that's a major thing. So when they start paying their workers a living wage, in addition to these other fine things, I might actually start buying their chickens. Maybe. Not promising, but maybe. And finally, here's the best news of all this week. It's only one more week to the freaking election. Hooray! Oh my God, am I so done with this election cycle? Am I so sickened by what it has brought bubbling to the surface of our national culture? I mean, ugh, you really just want to puke. It's embarrassing. It's mortifying. It's sad. It's shameful. It's just nothing but bad news. And I can't wait until it's over. And knock on wood, we have President Hillary Clinton sitting in the Oval Office, because really the alternative is just too horrible to even contemplate. And so on that cheerful note, we'll take a short break for a sponsor drop, and we'll come right back with the wonderful, the marvelous, and the amazing Anna LaPay. And we'll have a really fabulous talk about her, as she has just won the James Beard Foundation Award for Leadership. So stay tuned.
And this one's called Greenwood Cemetery by Teeth People. We'll be right back.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do. But the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. Dave, did I forget to introduce myself again this time? at the beginning of the show?
I can't remember.
Well, I might have, and so here I am doing it now. This is Katie Kiefer.
Oh,
speaking.
Yeah, that's right. You said, call me Aunt Katie.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, I did. Okay.
Of course.
And this is the Heritage Radio Network, of course, broadcasting live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today it's my very great pleasure and indeed my honor to announce my guest, Anna Lepe. Anna is a national, in case you don't know, and if you've been living under a rock, I suppose you could maybe not know about her, but anyway, is a national best-selling author and an internationally recognized expert on food systems. She is also a longtime fan of and partner with Corporate Accountability International. She is the author or co-author of three books, including Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It, and a contributing author to a dozen more. Since 2012, she has been working with Corporate Accountability International and other allies across the country to direct Real Food Media, a collaborative initiative to spark conversation about our food system, catalyze creative storytelling, and connect communities for action. The project produces the Food Mythbusters video series, well worth taking a look at, runs an international films competition, and leads special partnerships such as the Communications Campaign for Good Food Purchasing Programs nationwide with her mother, the estimable Frances Moore Lepe, a guest on this program about a year ago. Anna also co-founded the Small Planet Institute and Small Planet Fund, which has raised and given away more than $1 million to grassroots organizations around the world. She also serves as a consultant to foundations and philanthropists funding food system change and is developing a food funding program for a family foundation based in Marin. Well, thank you for joining me today, Anna.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. Honest to God. I mean, when I read bios like this, I just want to cry because, I mean, in all my 60 years, I have not done one-tenth of the many, many things that you have accomplished in your infinitely shorter span on this planet. But anyway, congratulations on your James Beard Foundation Award. Tell us about it.
Thank you. Thank you. So the Leadership Award at the James Beard Foundation, it's about 6 or 7 years old now, and I like to joke it's the award they give for the people who don't know how to cook. But right. I guess I know how to cook a little. But it's really their effort to recognize leaders in the field of food system change. So it was a huge honor to receive the award, and I definitely felt a bit overwhelmed by it, sitting there alongside people like John Boyd Jr., who was one of the awardees this year, who's the head of the National Black Farmers Association, and really helped lead the effort to sue the U.S. Department of Agriculture for long-term discrimination against black farmers and help win a class action lawsuit that brought more than $1 billion in funds to black farmers. So he is pretty amazing. I felt a little, in a different category than him, but there are leaders like that who are recognized. And so it was an incredible evening celebration, but also just really an incredible collection of leaders, so people can find out more by checking out the archives of the James Beard Foundation Leadership Awardees to see some of the amazing leaders they've recognized.
And was there a red carpet, and what did you wear? Were you wearing, Anna?
I gotta say, I really liked my dress. No, it was funny actually. The person who introduced me. So they pair every award winner with someone who introduces them. And this year, the person who recognized me is Deb Eschmeyer, who is the director of the First Ladies Let's Move initiative, and a longtime friend and ally of mine. And it really was this lovely kind of coming full circle where I had introduced her when she received the award 5 years ago. So it was great to have her honor me, and it was also hilarious. The last time we did an event together, we basically inadvertently almost wore the exact same dress, and at the award ceremony when we showed up, we looked at each other. We weren't wearing the exact same dress, but we were wearing the same designer, and she'd almost bought the dress I was wearing. So for the next event we do together, we're definitely going to make sure we're coordinating our wardrobes.
Absolutely. Well, great minds think alike, right? I mean, how perfect
exactly.
is that? Can you tell listeners, if they don't know about the Small Planet Institute and Real Food Media, give us a little three-minute update on what's going on there.
Sure. So the Small Planet Institute, I started with my mother, Frances Moore Lepe, who you mentioned in your opening remarks, an incredible woman, lifetime advocate for sustainable food systems, and a lifetime of myth-busting work she's done to try to really help people understand the root causes of hunger.
Right.
Really, from the earliest, her first book, her earliest days of doing this work in the early 1970s, she really help to explode the myth that I think many of us still hold today, but explode the myth that hunger on the planet is caused by a lack of food. Instead, what she's said for decades now is that we really need to understand hunger as a political phenomenon, that hunger isn't caused by a lack of productivity or a lack of production, but really a lack of democracy. And so for decades, she's been really trying to expose those underlying root causes of hunger and poverty. And the Institute is really our effort to continue that work. So we do public education. We've collectively written a number of books since we started the Institute, and bring together a network of other researchers and thinkers to do this public education work. And then Real Food Media is really an extension of that. I started it with partners, including Corporate Accountability International, to help elevate the story of the sustainable food solutions we see all around the country and really the world, and also to help people understand, kind of peel the curtain away of the multi-billion-dollar effort of the food industry to really shape what we think and feel and believe about food. So not just the efforts we're so aware of food marketing to buy certain products, but really the work to really shape what we think should be grown and how it should be grown and what kind of policies we think make sense. And so we do a lot of work at Real Food Media to help people understand the mechanism of public relations that the food industry is engaged in every year.
Wow, fascinating. I'm definitely going to check out the Corporate Accountability International. I've never heard of that group before, I'm ashamed to say. And they sound like somebody I would really enjoy having as, you know, a guest on this program. Right? Do you think so?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You might be familiar with their work because they were founded in the 70s. Their birth story is they were the group that rose up in response to the work that was discovered that Nestle, the global food company, was doing to market their infant formula in developing countries mothers in the developing South, global South, and what the organizers who eventually started Corporate Accountability discovered is that Nestle was actually undermining women's health and infant health by pushing infant formula on these mothers in, of course, places where the water wasn't necessarily safe to use, and places where women couldn't afford infant formula, places where women should really have been breastfeeding and encouraged to breastfeed. And so Corporate Accountability was born out of a global boycott of Nestle to really call attention to those practices. So you might be familiar with their origin.
Yeah.
And then over the decades, they've done work, similar work, kind of really taking on corporate malfeasance and really organizing the public to stand up for human rights, the basic human right to healthy food, safe water, and so on.
Right, right. Well, great organization. I certainly remember that campaign vividly, being sort of a child of the 70s, more or less. I'm a baby boomer.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I remember that very well. But let's talk a little bit about what's been going on in your world. And I wanted to see what you had to say about, the fact that climate change, and despite initiatives like Plate of the Union, which I had Ricardo Salvador on here two or three times. I had Claire from Food Policy Action. There was all this effort in the last year to get climate change and food policy issues into the political discussion during this campaign cycle. And even though these are two of the most pressing domestic policy issues that we face, nothing happened. So what would you like to see, as the first steps of a new administration when it comes to dealing with these two issues? I mean, assuming that, we get lucky, because I'm not counting out Donald Trump.
Assuming we get lucky and there's not Armageddon.
Yeah, exactly. Assuming we get lucky, we don't get the Antichrist. Yeah. What would you see as the first steps of a new administration in trying to address these two issues? Because they are pretty much,
they are
bound together.
Yeah. And I guess the way I look at this question is actually to kind of pull back and see. I feel like we sort of are at a moment of a tale of two cities when it comes to politics in this country, where there is this, I would argue, and I don't know if many people would disagree with me, a very broken, dysfunctional, depressing national discourse that's happening, and a kind of broken system at that federal level. Mm-hmm. But what I am seeing and what gives me hope and has really been inspiring is what I see happening at the state and local levels,
right,
where you actually are seeing really innovative policy being put forward and actually passing and actually taking root in states and cities around food policy and climate policy, and also the intersection of the two. So, for instance, here in California, there's a wonderful organization that's relatively new in the last 10 years, really taking off the last 5 years, called the called CalCan, which stands for the California California Climate and Agriculture Network. Uh-huh. And CalCan has just helped, with a huge coalition of groups, helped to pass the first healthy soils legislation in this country that would take some of the money that's coming into the state coffers here in California around our climate action policies, help take some of that money and actually put it towards supporting farmers that are deploying practices that build healthy soil, with the idea being healthy soil is, of course, good for growing great food, but healthy soil is also great for increasing the carbon content in soils and bringing that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it in soils. So that's an example of the kind of policy that gets me really excited. Of course, if I could wave my magic wand and see that passed at the federal level, I would be so happy. But I also feel like a lot of people feel, I think, so frustrated with the gridlock at the national level and kind of throw up their hands in hopelessness. And I think there's a lot that can be achieved in one at the state and local level.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Absolutely. I think, I mean, it is clearly happening in the state and local level. And much as I would like to see federal mandates about how we, you know, how we rule agriculture, I agree with you. Gridlock is not going away unless we have an incredible election this year. So, one thing you pointed out, though, in an interview is that Hillary Clinton is kind of in bed with the soda industry. You know, she supported a soda tax, then she quickly sort of rolled that back. But in a proxy debate, she sent Kathleen Merrigan as her surrogate, who I'm actually hoping to have on the show next week, and which would suggest a more progressive agenda. If she gains the presidency, do you think she will be likely to return to doing things like supporting a soda tax, or even something like mandating or putting into the farm bill subsidies for farmers who build healthy soils, who get, you know, some sort of tax abatement or otherwise incentivized financially to change the way that they're doing their business of agriculture?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great question, and I feel like if anyone wants to do some fascinating reading, dive into the WikiLeaks reporting on the John Podesta email. So John Podesta, mm-hmm. for those of you who don't know, is campaign manager for Clinton's campaign. And out of those emails, as well as you can see the a number of other emails from Clinton advisors, what is really clear to me is that to the extent that there have been progressive policy discussions coming out of the Clinton campaign or from Clinton herself, what you see in the WikiLeaks emails is that those have really come out of her responding to pressure from the left, pressure from progressives, pressure from activists. And so one could say, oh, well, that's so disheartening that she didn't hold those values close to her heart, whether it's the $15 minimum wage or the soda tax or any of these other issues that we might really care about. On the other hand, what you can see from these emails is that she's movable, which is a positive, and that it really does remind, I think, me, and it should remind all of us, that let's, again, hope she gets into office. It's really important that we continue to push on these issues. So, you know, you mentioned the soda tax issue. So, yeah, she came out for the soda tax in Philadelphia, and in the WikiLeaks emails, you can see almost within, I think it was less than 24 hours, consultants to Coca-Cola were reaching out to her campaign and saying, you know, backtrack on that. What does she do? You know, really pushing her to rescind her support for the soda taxes. If you looked at the John Podesta list of her short list for VP, Mukhtar Kent, who's CEO of Coca-Cola, was on that short list. You know, I think we just need to know that having her in office doesn't mean that we're, you know, it's not a free ticket to seeing everything we want to see policy-wise around food. Yeah. We really have to push her on it. And, you know, Kathleen Merrigan, you know, that was so great to see her elevate Kathleen Merrigan in that way. I haven't seen Merrigan's name on any short list for USDA. I would love to. So what can we do to help, you know, push her in that direction? There's there's a lot that would need to be done if and when we can all cross our fingers she is our next president.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I find it very curious that, you know, with all the pressure that has been brought on her about food policy change and, you know, trying to make that into a national a part of the national discussion, that something that is so close to sort of the women and children's issues that she has championed over the decades, it seemed to me that you know, moving forward in a progressive way towards food policy and agriculture would have dovetailed so beautifully with those stated ideals. And yet somehow it just didn't, she couldn't, you know, I guess her campaign people just couldn't figure out how to make that sexy enough for the voting public. I mean, I would have thought it would be a natural for her to embrace the idea of a soda tax because of the impact on children's health and children's teeth and, you know, just stuff like that, like make those direct links between what soda does to families and, you know, and her campaign. It was really surprising to me that she
Right. It's like that should be the easy sell. And absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she's really run on this. You know, I fought my whole life for children and for families and for women. And all of the food issues we care about are issues that relate to families and children's health. And
absolutely.
I think to me, it speaks to just how much influence the food industry has on campaigns. And I think that speaks more to our campaign finance system than necessarily Hillary Clinton as a specific candidate. But I think that she's not immune to that at all. And I think that, again, it's why the more that we can expose those connections, the more that we can really push her and other elected officials to embrace the values that they say they hold dear. As you say, these are the values that she says she's campaigning on, and to say, look, if you're going to say you those are the values that you hold dear, then these are the policies that reflect those values.
Exactly. I know. It's really amazing. But to go back to what we were talking a few minutes ago about the successes that are seen on the state and local levels, you've been working with the Good Food Purchasing Policy, and I've actually done a program around that actually myself quite a while ago with the Food Chain Workers Alliance with Jose. But you guys have done a lot of work in L.A., and can you talk a little bit about it, the Good Food Purchasing Policy, and how you see that changing the food procurement landscape? You know, what is the difference going to be, whether are you buying it off a Cisco truck or are you getting it from somebody local kind of thing?
Well, most people I talk to about this have never heard of it before. So in a nutshell, for listeners who don't know what this policy is, I like to think of it as kind of what LEED certification is for buildings.
Right.
The Good Food Purchasing Policy is for public food procurement. In other words, it's a values lens through which government officials can make decisions about which bids they accept for their food purchases. So instead of looking at, who's the cheapest supplier, they look through a set of five core values, and their values I think we all would share. Their values around environmental sustainability, animal welfare, nutrition, worker well-being, as well as local regional economies. So those are the five values, and to be able to be a supplier into either school district or city government that has embraced this policy, you as a supplier have to meet just minimum basic criteria around those five values. And then the policy really is an inspirational one to really try to push and encourage suppliers to score better and better across those five values. So you don't have to be organic certified to be able to, say, for instance, meet that environmental sustainability criteria, but the policy really encourages you to go to that highest level, to go to that third-party certification of organic, for instance. So what I love about the policy is that all five of these values are at play. You can't, as a district, school district, or as a supplier, say, we really just care about animal welfare. That's really the value we want to support, and we're not really paying attention to these other issues. Mm-hmm. Instead, what the policy is about is saying, look, these five values, they come together. They are unified. They are of a piece. And if you want to work within our school district, then we really want you to embrace and have practices that reflect these five values. And as a result, when you look at the organizing work that it takes to bring these policies into play and to also make sure that their implementation is strong. What's fabulous about the policy is it brings together a really strong coalition. So you have labor at the table. You have animal rights activists at the table. You have so many different groups together at the table because the policy reflects these five values. So it passed in 2012 at the school district level in Los Angeles and was really piloted there. And as a result, we've seen really incredible impact in Los Angeles. And now the group that brought the policy into being in Los Angeles has broken off into a standalone organization that is called the Center for Good Food Purchasing, and it is really providing support for the grassroots campaigns that are trying to pass the policy now in cities across the country. And then even I think more importantly, what this center does is provide the technical assistance and the kind of intellectual support to policymakers who, once they pass it, to say, okay, here's how you implement it. Here's how you really make sure that it isn't just words on paper, but it actually is making a difference in classrooms, in lunchrooms, in hospitals, and so on.
Right, right. And so right now it's LA is the only city working on this, but they're hoping to, you and they are hoping to take this across the nation. What do you think the chances
No, actually, it passed earlier this year. San Francisco Unified School District was the second district in the country. Oakland Unified is poised to pass the policy in a week or so. Together, those three districts buy about $200 million worth of food a year. So we're talking really significant food purchasing.
Yes.
And then the most exciting, very exciting, I should say, news from last week is that the Los Angeles airports just agreed to pass the policy.
Oh, no kidding.
So it's really exciting. And then those are just the ones that have passed or really like Oakland about to pass the policy. But across the country, we have active campaigns in a number of cities, big, including very big cities, Chicago, Minneapolis, Austin. A number of cities are actively pursuing the policy. And then just in the past few months, since we've launched the public-facing websites about this work and really starting to get it out there, we've gotten queries from cities across the country. So it's very exciting.
That is very exciting. And it brings up to me a question about supply. Because if you suddenly have a huge demand for products that reflect those five core values, those five core values are not universal within the agricultural community, whether it's the meat industry or fruits and vegetables. And so if it really goes as fast as it seems to be, this is definitely a problem you want to have, but still,
right.
Isn't that an issue?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And this is where I feel like procurement policies have this power to really change supply chain. So
absolutely.
I'll just give you one example from Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
because you're right, the supply is not there right now to meet it. If we had the great fortune of all these policies passing, at this very moment, the supply wouldn't necessarily be there, but you can see how quickly things can change. I'll give you this example from Los Angeles, which I love. The CEO of the food distribution company that was supplying LA Unified many food items, including their breads and rolls, once the policy passed, started for the first time having a real curiosity about his own supply chain. These values were not necessarily the values he was using to look at his supply.
Right.
But the policy got him to think differently, and one of the things he started looking at is where his wheat was coming from. He never thought about that before, but he realized it was coming from chemical growers growing conventional wheat in one of the Dakotas. And he started thinking, how could I score higher and better for my bread into the district? And he found a company based in the Northwest that had growers in the Central Valley that he then approached and said, hey, listen, if you grow this wheat, and he was looking at a wheat that isn't your, traditional conventional wheat, but higher quality wheat. If you grow this wheat, I commit that I will buy it from you, and I'll buy at a certain level because I need to have enough for the LA Unified School District. Mm-hmm. And then he went to the bakery that he was working with and said, look, I want you to use this flour. It's going to be different, but I promise no matter how those rolls turn out, I will buy them from you. I'm a committed buyer, and I will you know, keep my promise on our contract. And he actually brought a mill online to mill the wheat.
Amazing.
And as a result, I think it's something like 550 million bread rolls every year in LA Unified School District. Some huge number. But he totally changed the supply.
Right.
And, you know, it didn't happen in 24 hours, but it happened within a year.
Yeah.
And so what it was a sort of unleashing creativity, unleashing a new way of looking at supply chains as a result of this policy that we saw happen in that bread example that I think is really exciting.
Oh, I agree with you completely. But I, you know, to again, to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here, one of the reasons that our food costs are so low as a nation is that agricultural and processing. Wait, there's another question I want to ask you before we get to wages for workers. But when we talk about revamping those agricultural methods, like saying, you know, to a farmer, well, you've been growing this kind of product for, you know, X number of years and you've invested in that infrastructure. And now, you know, I'd really like it if you did something else, you know, and I will commit to buying that. But then the guy is maybe has to, you know, invest in a lot of different equipment or different seeds that cost him more money or something like that. I mean, you know, a lot of times these changes could be helped along with farm bill subsidies and insurance. But there's also the factor of the farmer himself who's like, well, I'm worried. I'm not going to be able to make my nut. What if what if I don't sell enough of this product? Or what if it doesn't really grow in my soil? Or what if I've invested in something and it doesn't work out for me? It's like, I feel like there's a piece missing in terms of like the education of farmers or the concern over farmers changing methods that they've been employing for decades, for better or worse. And, you know, how we're going to address that piece of it, you know, as well as, mm-hmm. you know, as well as getting somebody who mm-hmm. buys the stuff to agree to do, to buy a different product, but then getting a farmer to agree to change his methods is another entire question that is a really important one, I think. How do you feel like farmers are addressing that?
It's a great question. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think this question, raises, I think, the central point that if we're talking about changing the food system, then we need systemic solutions. You can't just come in with one intervention, right, and say, okay, the policy's changed. Now, everybody, change your practices.
Right.
It really needs to be holistic. And that's why, a policy like this is trying to work in lockstep with a whole range of other food system reform efforts that have to do with, you mentioned a number of these, in your question, you mentioned a number of these things that also need to change. Everything from what kind of research are we funding? What kind of training programs are we offering farmers to retrain in some of these new methods? How are we talking to the finance sector so that you don't have a situation like I've heard from farmers who've told me stories of how their local rural bank would be happier and more comfortable giving them $500,000 loan for them to become a contract farmer for Tyson than to give them a $10,000 loan for them to put up a hoop house to for their organic produce production, because the bank doesn't know what a hoop house is but's familiar with Tyson. So, you know, there's finance sector reforms that need to happen.
Huge.
There's insurance sector reforms that need to happen.
Yeah.
I think that you're right. We don't want to be simplistic about the solutions we're talking about, because you're talking about real people who are, living on the margins already, who making these changes can, be a serious shift in their production. What I will say, though, is talking to groups that work with farmers to transition them to these practices is that, and this is what is very encouraging, is that farmers want stability, of course. Farmers want to feel like they're, that they're not every year wondering, what their fate is going to be. And so when you talk about relationships like the ones that this distribution company is building with his supply chain around Los Angeles, those farmers are thrilled to have a buyer who is a good, honest buyer, instead of buyers like, for instance, big box stores like Walmart, that when you sign a contract with Walmart as a farmer, what you are signing is a contract that says at any point Walmart could cancel and say, forget it, that broccoli you just grew all, that harvest you just did for us, forget it, we don't want to buy it. Walmart sets the price, can change the price at any time.
Right.
So when you're talking about a supplier that can provide that kind of stable purchasing, committed purchasing, it really does change the dynamic. And then you also hear, one of my favorite groups is a group called the Practical Farmers of Iowa. And, you know, you hear about these groups like the Practical Farmers of Iowa that are helping conventional farmers shift to more sustainable practices. And what I hear from them and their organizers is that, you know, farmers really welcome this support. And, you know, they know that they're those who are trapped in the chemical treadmill. They know they're in a treadmill. Right. They see the weed resistance growing. They see the problems on their farm. They see the seed prices for genetically engineered seeds skyrocketing. You know, if they're given a lifeline out, as long as there's that support, I feel like, you know, when I talk to farmers who are transitioning, that there's a real excitement around it. But again, we cannot be simplistic about it, and we also have to acknowledge that there's so many other supports that farmers need to be making this shift.
Absolutely. I mean, I sat next to a farmer at the Nyman Ranch dinner last year, I think it was, and, you know, he had been doing conventional pork raising, and it was truly what you describe, a lifeline. He could not stand what was happening to his pigs. I mean, this is a guy who literally asked me, I said, why don't you come and visit New York? Because, of course, he's never been to New York. And he said, only if I can bring my pigs. Oh. I was practically in tears. I mean, the guy loves his livestock. And, yes, right. It's destined for slaughter. But, like, that doing it in that, you know, as a contract farmer, the way he had been doing it, it was not happy for him. And he really was so happy to be part of the Nyman Ranch family. It was a sweet moment. I wanted to go also into the labor issue, because that's another piece of the puzzle. I mean, especially with the meat workers, but even also all agricultural workers, you know, I remember hearing Michael Hurwitz from the Green Market in New York for Grow NYC. And he was talking about, you know, he deals with farmers every day, obviously, because he runs all the markets in New York City. And he said, you know, the problem with raising wages for farm workers to $15 an hour or better is that most farmers, again, operate on such a thin margin. He said the guys that he works with, you know, they might love their workers, their agricultural teams that come in every year to help them pick their harvest. They might have long-term relationships with them that go back even generations, but they literally do not have the money to pay them the $15 an hour that they deserve and that they even might want to pay them. And that's another place where, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, but there's not a lot of sort of practical examination of how a farmer would, in fact, be able to, could he raise his prices enough to reflect that that better working wage? Could he get subsidies that would somehow offset the cost of that? You know, like that's another, to me, another big issue where, you know, we say, oh, yes, we can do this. And then it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, it's not so easy. What do you think about that? What does your crystal ball tell you on that score?
Yeah, no, it's a really critical question, you know, and I think we're not just talking about farm workers, but just food workers across the food chain.
Yep.
You know, eight of the 10 worst paying jobs in this economy are in the food sector. So you're talking pretty much, you know, pick your food worker, and they're some of the lowest paid, most exploited. So how do we get around this? And, you know, I think that there's, you know, it's a different scenario for really, really small scale farmers. Maybe those, you know, the farmers that Michael Hurwitz, you know, is really working most closely with. I, you know, because when I turn my eye to, you know, the bigger growers that have, you know, farm workers still getting paid, you know, just sub-poverty wages, mm-hmm. I'm reminded that, you know, if you look historically at the height of farm worker organizing and power in the early 70s, mm-hmm. where you look at, you know, you had high-skilled farm workers, you know, who are especially, you know, cauliflower, broccoli, cabbage, you know, some of these really high-skilled picking jobs. You had farm workers under union contract that were making in today's dollars about $30 an hour.
Wow. I did not know that.
And I did not know that either until, you know, sort of digging into this history. And it wasn't like we were all paying exorbitant amounts of money for our cabbage or our cauliflower.
Right.
You know, it's the economics. You've got to remember that when you look at what fraction of our food dollars actually goes to a farm worker, you know, in sort of in general, or, you know, and then or a farmer if we're buying from, you know, a farmer that's operating his or her own farm, you're talking about a tiny fraction of our dollars. I remember a study done recently from the United Farm Workers that looked at how much more would a Californian shopper need to spend on their strawberries for farm workers to get, who are picking strawberries to get a living wage. And it was like 5 5 cents more per pint of strawberries. And most consumers, when you ask them, would say, we'd pay that. We'd pay that in a second.
It's true.
In a heartbeat.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's like the Immokalee tomato pickers. They wanted a penny a pound more. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. So a penny a pound for the Immokalee farm workers in Florida sounds like nothing to you and me.
Right.
It doubled their wages.
Right. Right.
So we need to remember, I mean, I think this cost question is a critical one. I think it often gets painted as, well, there's just no way that we can pay our workers more. There's just no way without raising prices for consumers. And frankly, when you look at the economics of the especially larger food companies, that it's simply not true. Historically, we have paid more, and it's when you look at where the dollars are going, they're simply getting concentrated in the very, very top end of these businesses, where you have the highest paying, whether CEO, highest paying, employees and highest paying folks getting so much money and so much going to marketing and so much going to other aspects of the business and so little going to the worker.
Right. Well, so much of it goes, because that leads me to my last question, because that's all we have time for. But and so much money going to lobbying. So let's talk a little bit about lobbying. why do you think that the progressive food movement has been, I feel like we do not lobby Congress effectively or consistently. And even though most of the people in Congress, with a few notable exceptions, most people in Congress are kind of like the procurement guy that you were talking about earlier in the show, mm-hmm. who had no idea that his supply, he got curious about his supply chain. And I think it is also true that most people in Congress who vote on agricultural matters or environmental for that matter, literally have no idea of exactly what it is that the whole picture is. And so I'm always curious, like, why aren't we, sending more effective people on a regular basis to discuss issues around workers' rights, environmental concerns, agricultural policy, school food, et cetera. I feel like we don't do enough with the actual people who are passing legislation, and I wondered if you would address that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right. And even hearing you ask that question, I'm like, I've got to go lobby on Capitol Hill.
I know, right? You do.
Let's meet in D.C. and I'll visit those offices. It is happening. I don't want to say that we don't. I mean,
no,
one of
does.
My favorite organizations, if anyone wants to, see kind of who from our side is doing this so well, one of my favorite organizations is the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, NSAC, and they do incredible lobbying. And I think lobbying is a bit of a dirty word, but they do incredible, let's call it, educating our elected officials on the issues and, really helping to craft fabulous progressive policy. So there are some groups that do it. I would say that part of the answer to your question is that not to sort of make excuses for our side, but to really underscore just how much money is spent from the food industry lobbying. And when we talk about the food industry, I think it's important for people to remember that, when you look at the industrial food system, the industries that have a stake in the status quo, it's not just agribusiness producing, the commodity crops.
Right.
You're talking about the oil industry. You're talking now about the pharmaceutical industry.
Absolutely.
The fastest growing and most profitable sector of pharmaceuticals is animal pharma because of factory farms.
Yep.
So you're talking about the pharmaceutical industry has a stake in this. You're talking about the food processors, the restaurant association. There's so many trade groups, the sugar association, the beverage association.
Corn.
So you're talking about a lot of groups that have a stake in the status quo that have money and are spending it on lobbying on Capitol Hill. So we need to do more, but I also feel like, unfortunately, there's just huge forces, at play here in terms of this lobbying force.
Yeah. I would just like to see, like, you know, as you said, it's not even lobbying so much as education, so that these guys can actually make an informed decision about the votes that they're casting. Because, I mean, for example, I visited Congress recently myself just a couple months ago, and I stopped into one guy's office, you know, from the Republican Party. And not only did he tell me that the industry runs food policy, and so what was the problem, but he then told me, so my response was, well, what about the 42 million food insecure households in the United States? And his jaw dropped. I don't think he knew that. I literally do not think he knew that.
That's depressing.
And then he was like, well, I don't want to be on your show because, you know, you're obviously coming from the wrong point of view. I mean, it was just like, anyway, I want you to now take a moment to promote yourself, promote all that you do, tell people where they can learn more about what you do and how to support it. So take it away, girlfriend.
Sure. So people can check out Real Food Media's work at realfoodmedia.org. The two other things I would mention is, we didn't mention already, is that we are running an online book club. So for those of you who want to dig deeper into food issues, you can join Real Food Reads, which is our book club where we have podcasts up with authors, and we're just about to announce our 2017 lineup for books. So if you have a favorite book you want to recommend, let us know.
And we encourage recommend
people
mine,
to
Anna.
Host their own book clubs, and we have recipes that we recommend for you to make for your in-person book clubs with friends and community members. We also have a free resource at realfoodfilms.org, mm-hmm. where you can watch short films on food streaming online. You can also host pop-up film festivals. We provide resources for people around the world to host their own festivals. And if you are excited about good food purchasing and you want to see how your city can embrace the policy, you can go to goodfoodcities.org and you can learn more about it there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining me on the program today. It was truly a pleasure. I love talking to somebody who's as well informed and articulate as you are. And I just enjoyed every single minute of this. So I really appreciate your time, Anna. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. I loved it too.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. And thank you to my sponsor, otherwise known as New York State Grown and Certified. Really appreciate your support for the station. And folks, we're coming into our fall fundraising drive. If you have not hit the donate button and joined our family, our growing family, over 1 million people tune into Heritage Radio Network a month now. That wasn't the case 7 years ago when we started this fantastic experiment. So know that you are appreciated, that we love and appreciate all of our listeners around the world. But we also need to have your donations in order to continue to do the kind of work we do and to have people like Anna LaPay on the network on a regular basis. So thanks for listening and have a great week. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.